place with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Brown Bag Deli Restaurant, Homemade Pies by Inge, Gourmet Foods, Cards and Gifts, as well as Zimmer Art Gallery, Wacky Nackies, The Buzz Cafe, Prairie Fire Glass, and Any Frequency Music Store, all housed on the same street in downtown Monticello.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us to start out another week. In the first hour today, we'll be talking about a subject that has been a major concern here in our community in Champaign-Urbana and at the University of Illinois and in the area around the campus, and that is pedestrian safety. In the past few years, there have been several fatal accidents in the U of I campus area that involve pedestrians and vehicles, and these have led officials from the university and also from Urbana and Champaign to take a closer look at the movement of traffic around the campus area. We'll be talking a little bit this morning about the ways that cities manage conflict between people on foot and people on wheels, and we have two guests with us, both joining us by phone. Fred Rank is a safety engineer with the Federal Highway Administration. He is somebody who works in this center where they provide technical support to division offices, highway division offices and states across the country. He is a professional traffic operations engineer. He's a graduate of the University of Illinois, has degrees in engineering, bachelor's and master's here from the U of I. He's also worked as a city traffic engineer for the fourth largest municipality in the state and the seventh fastest growing city in the nation for 12 years. He is joining us by telephone. Also with us is John LaPlante. He is currently the vice president and chief transportation planning engineer for T.Y. Lynn International. That's a civil and structural engineering firm that specializes in planning, design, and construction of transportation infrastructure. He's worked on a number of projects in the Chicago area, including the relocation of Lakeshore Drive west of Soldier Field, the McCormick Place West expansion, Southwest Michigan non-motorized transportation plan, the O'Hare Intermodal Station study, and several bikeway and pedestrian projects for the city. He also, before that, worked for the city of Chicago for 30 years in various positions involved in the transportation engineering area. He's been president of the Illinois Engineering Council and the Western Society of Engineers, and he is joining us by phone as well. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome from people here in Champaign-Urbana. The number, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. I'm also mention, by the way, that our guests here, the two of them, were here in Champaign-Urbana back in the winter, this was in February, for a special workshop meeting with here people locally to talk about pedestrian safety around the campus area. And we were going to have them on the program at that time, and I had to be away, and we ended up having to reschedule it, but I'm really pleased that the both of them could be with us in this form, if not in person, here on the telephone. So again, for people who have questions, and certainly we welcome that, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Well, Mr. LaPlante, hello.
Good morning, David.
And Mr. Rank, hello to you.
Good morning, David.
I have to ask you, I was reading off your bio here, I have to ask you, well, what exactly is the fourth largest municipality in Illinois? What town is that?
Well, it's Naperville.
Naperville.
And it's either second, third, or fourth largest, depending which city, Peoria, Aurora or Naperville, has the latest special census, which usually puts them at a higher number as all three are continuing to grow. Aurora is probably growing the fastest, though.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of your experience is up there in DuPage County, right?
Yes. And by the way, that little town of Naperville was identified as the second best place to live in America a couple of years ago.
Well, I have
part of it is it's excellent pedestrian facilities and accommodation.
Yeah, I have some family up there in DuPage County, so I'm somewhat familiar with the area. Well, I'm glad that both of you could be with us. Maybe I could ask, is it just a very general question, and then we already have a caller here, somebody who would like to jump into the conversation. What we want to talk about basically is, what are the design features of a community that foster walkability, that not only encourage people to walk, but make it easy and one would hope, safe for people to walk? I'll just start with Fred Rank. Is there a way of briefly just talking about what exactly that means?
Yes, I'd be glad to. What in pure, straight, and simple terms, having a place to walk out of the street, out of the traffic way, out of the highway, where the vehicles are, either on a shoulder in a rural setting or on a sidewalk in a more urban setting, being able to cross the street safely at places that pedestrians need to, want to cross, and being able to break up the crossing path if it's a long one into shorter segments. All of these things improve pedestrian safety, facilitate the pedestrian to be able, to be one of the modes that all get along with each other in the same public right-of-way.
Well, and I'll turn to John LaPant. I don't know if now Fred Rank has answered the question and there's nothing that you could add. Is that the basic thing?
Yeah, the only I'd agree with everything Fred has said. I would add one of the crucial items in an urban area is having the cars travel at a relatively lower speed travel speed. Anything over 30 miles an hour becomes very problematic for pedestrians to try and cross the street and have a car be able to stop if they see a pedestrian at the last minute, and that becomes very crucial.
Okay. Well, we do have a caller here, and I will not make them wait longer. We'll bring them right in, someone who is listening in Urbana and on our line number one right here. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
My question was, and I hope it's okay to ask about bikes. I think bikes are sort of part of the mix, and in some ways are kind of like pedestrians. And there's been a lot of letters to the editor in our paper recently about bikes. And I'll kind of paraphrase the most recent one, and I wondered if I could get your response. It was from somebody who I imagine is a driver and maybe not familiar with riding on a bike, who says things like bicyclists should be using bike paths and sidewalks, and ride only on the side of the road but not in the lanes or not in the traffic turn lanes, and that the bikes are basically pedestrians and not motor vehicles and the streets are for cars. And I think that's a feeling that lots of people who only drive cars maybe have, but I think actually some of those suggestions aren't really the safest. And people who ride bikes know that maybe sometimes being on the sidewalk isn't the safest and just staying right on the curb or right on the very edge of the road isn't the safest thing. So I wondered if you could kind of respond and answer that question of, are bikes a vehicle, or are they a pedestrian, and where do they belong, and how can people who maybe only have driven understand that the bikes should be in a safe place for them, if you could respond to that.
Okay. Well, certainly bikes are encouraged, and you want to make, when people are thinking about here, planning out traffic movement here in Champaign-Urbana around the campus area, there's a strong belief that there ought to be a place for bikes. How do you, I guess that's the question, though, how do you provide that good, safe place for riders?
David, that's a real good question. This is John LaPlante, and I've done a lot of bicycle planning here for the city of Chicago, where we have over 200 miles of bicycle routes now, and mostly on street. On street is, well, number one, a bicycle is a vehicle. By state law, a bicycle is a vehicle, not a pedestrian. If we're talking about children riding bicycles and they're at very low speeds, they should be on a sidewalk. But for the most part, bicyclists, adult bicyclists, should be in a street because they are far safer in the street. What happens in terms of crashes, the total fatalities of bicyclists riding the right direction in a street is less than 10%, or roughly 10% of all the fatals for bicyclists. The vast majority of bicycle crashes occur at intersections, many of which are bicyclists riding on side paths or riding the wrong way in a street, because it happens at the intersections where a person is pulling out, and they're not looking. They're looking at the sidewalk to see if there's a pedestrian right there, but they're not looking way down the sidewalk to see if a cyclist is coming along at 10, 15, 20 miles an hour, and they just get hit, and that's where most of your crashes occur. And so the idea is to have the cyclist in a lane, if possible, on the street. If not possible, sharing the lane with the cars. I remember I said one of the things for pedestrians is to have the cars going slower, and if the bicyclists force the cars to go slower, that's not a bad thing at all. It makes the whole system operate safer.
This is Fred Rank. Well put, John, and I'm glad you spoke up first on it with all of your years of experience with Chicago's bike facilities. the essence of the whole situation is, well, who's compatible with what? There needs to be a space for the bicyclists, just as there does for the pedestrians. Where you put it is a matter of context in regard to the speed and the amount of traffic and trucks on the street, but there needs to be a space. Congress spoke clearly in the Highway Act of 1999 that all modes should be accommodated, and that when they say all modes, that means bicycles and pedestrians, as well as vehicular traffic within the public right-of-way. And the accommodations for PEDs, the accommodations for bikes, are to be included in all projects which receive federal funding.
You know, I can understand the frustration of cyclists. I must say that I spend a lot of my time as a pedestrian, and I am a little frustrated sometimes with people, with grown-ups, this is now adults, riding their bicycles on the sidewalk, because I feel that, that's for me as a pedestrian. But then I'm also sympathetic with the cyclist, because it can be very difficult to ride in traffic, because I think often drivers will not cut cyclists any slack, and it actually can, I feel it can actually can be dangerous. At least if it was me, it was out there riding in the traffic, I would be very nervous. And it seems that the ideal would be to make a place that is, and this I suppose gets back to the idea of, they call it complete streets, or maybe there's another term, and I'm mistaking that. Anyway, the idea that if you had to design from the ground up a street, you would design it so there was a place for cars, there was a place for bicycles, and that they were separate, and that there also was a place for people to walk. And in a sense that there were three separate traffic paths that didn't, so that all the forms of transportation didn't have to share the same space with each other. Everybody had their own dedicated space.
This is Fred Rank. David well stated in terms of the perspective on what it takes to make things all work together, that is the street with vehicles with and for bicyclists and for PEDs. The complete street is the concept of accommodating all modes. And strangely enough, it doesn't take a brand new street to do so. The majority of the complete street installations are retrofit of existing streets using the widths that are there, remarking them, re-identifying them, setting up the signing and the marking so that bikes as well as vehicles can use the street space and have a separate space for pedestrians. The majority of the critical needs for pedestrians are where there is no sidewalk, where there are gaps in sidewalk, where there are facilities and attractions that pedestrians want to get to, and the only way that they can get there is to walk in the street or walk a dirt path that may or may not be even wide enough to get through on.
Mm. Well, I'm really interested to hear you say that it's not necessary for to widen streets to be able to accommodate all of these users. And I guess that would have been my assumption that, well, somehow you can't do it on the conventional street. You've got to have more space. But you say, no, that's actually not the case.
Many suburban streets in Illinois are more than wide enough. It's just remarking or re-identifying the space within the street so it can be used by vehicles and bikes. And the key aspect here came out in the earliest part of our discussion. A place for the pedestrian to be rather than out in the traffic space where the vehicles are and walking along a street or a highway.
Yeah.
And a place for the bicyclists where they can feel comfortable. Most of our streets, many of our streets were built or designed with 12-foot lanes, which is for a 30-mile-per-hour street, that's the same width lane as you put on out on I-90 or whatever. It's the same width as for interstates as for 30-mile-per-hour streets, and that really isn't necessary. So you can gain a lot of space often by reducing the lane widths, and which also then helps to slow the traffic down, which again gets you back to a more reasonable urban situation. There are also cases where you sometimes have more lanes than what you need, or you'll have two lanes in each direction, and that left lane is always blocked by cars turning left. And so if you make it three lanes with a two-way left turn lane and just one lane in each direction, you don't lose any capacity, but you've now gained another lane that you can cut in half and put into bike lanes on each side.
Let's talk with someone else. We have someone calling here from the nearby community of Rantoul. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm just tickled pink to be able to talk to you. I'm both a car driver, both Motorcycle Safety Foundation certificates from the University of Illinois, beginner's experience. I ride a bike a lot and I walk a lot. and I'm very concerned about pedestrians. But as I ride a bike, sometimes out of necessity, I come to a traffic signal, particularly anytime if I'm by myself, and I can't get it to switch. So I put a magnet underneath my crankset and got a bigger one and bigger one. I go down to the police station and ask them, what do I do to trigger the traffic signal? And they don't know. I go to the engineering department, and they look up something in a file and says, we don't know. So we think some of it's TV camera, some of it's something else. And, you know, how can I obey the rules of the road if I come to a red light, I'm the only one there, and I sit there and wait for 5 minutes, and it hasn't switched, and I've got a big magnet underneath my crankset. I'm right over that coil, because in Motorcycle Safety Foundation class years ago, we were told, get your motorcycle engine block right over that coil so you can switch that signal. And so how do I deal with this?
Well, I'll be glad to answer. Fred Rank here.
Yeah.
Long-time traffic signal person dealing with the very issue. The reality of it is that traffic signal detectors, which in Illinois tend to be 6x6 saw cut detection loops cut into the pavement in the lanes.
That's right.
If you position your bicycle, even the highest amount of non-metallic, non-ferrous material bicycles and the modern trail bikes, the composite materials, there's enough steel in those to trigger, to be detectable by almost all of the modern loop detector amplifiers that are out there. In investigating this 12, 15 years ago, it's not a matter of the wrong, as long as you've got fairly modern equipment, 15 years or younger, it'll pick them up. And the way to do it's not to be in the middle of the loop, but in fact to position your bicycle or motorcycle right over the top of the saw cut. There is now in the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices a sign and a marking that can be placed on the pavement if the loop is not readily visible, if it's been resurfaced over, and essentially says to get to call the signal, put your bike on this marking to call. Almost all the modern traffic signal equipment, and I say modern, anything in the last 15 years will work just fine. Video detection works fine to pick up bicyclists, detect them. The key thing, again, is where you're positioned to be able to be detected. I'd urge you to go back to the if you're in Urbana, go to the City of Urbana Engineering. If you're in Champaign, go to Champaign Engineering in the city. They both have capable people who will be glad to help you.
Fred, okay, I live in Rantoul, and I don't ride to Champaign that often.
Oh, okay. Well, then go to the City of Rantoul.
They don't have answers.
The same issues with them.
They don't know which is which. That's the sad thing is that they can't give me an answer.
Well, they should be able to because the information is widely available, and it's available from the manufacturers of the signal equipment they're buying.
Yeah, would that manufacturer be listed on the box on the side of the intersection? I go get on the internet and look.
It's still better just for ask them to go back to who supplied them the detection equipment and ask them to help you. This issue has been addressed in most cities across the country without a problem.
Fred, this is... Fred, this is John LaPlante. I just want to throw in, there have been cases where the loop detection has not been set low enough. Because you can change that the level of detection, because you don't want to have it too low, because then they'll start picking up cars going by in the other lane across the way. But often they set it too low, or not often, but occasionally. And that may be the problem, and it may not have anybody like at the county or whoever is running those signals who knows enough about their own equipment to know how to go into the box and change that, and it may require them contacting the manufacturer, whoever, as Fred said, whoever supplied him with the information to send one of their people out there and to set it correctly.
Well, it's been my past history. When it comes up something like that, I got to do the legwork and end up helping them and do it myself.
Okay. Let me tell you something. You don't need to add a magnet to the bottom of your bicycle crank or that. That's. Can I tell you, it's not going to help you in any way, one way or another.
Okay. Well, I was trying, you know. Because if I run a red light at 10:30 at night and a police officer pulls me over, I just say, hey, look, I'm trying to do my best. Look at the size of that magnet I got underneath there. I'm trying to trigger that thing properly.
Well, you could carry a manhole cover, too, but I'm not sure that really is a good approach.
Yeah. The TV camera systems, how can I tell that this is a TV camera system operated? I see the cutouts in the pavement.
And if there's cutouts in the pavement, then it really is a loop system. If you can't see any cutouts, you start looking out on the poles, and there'll be like little tiny camera boxes, or at least some kind of a detector unit that is pointed at or over the lane. So that would be the clue that it's.
Now there's some detectors that are designed to pick up the pulsating of headlights of an emergency vehicle, like a fire truck or an ambulance or law enforcement car. I suppose those got a different type of lens assembly, so you can see, okay, that's that. I'm not worried about trying to figure out which is a TV camera, because I'm worried about someone spying on me. I just want to know which intersection's which, so I can behave properly, you know.
Again, if I could, Fred Rank, I'd really urge you to work with your city engineering department. They should be able to help you.
I just have to spend a whole lot more time with them, because they were not real helpful at the time I tried talking with them. But I think I'll have to just go down there and tell them that I talked to you gentlemen on a radio show and try to figure out which is which, because...
Well, David, if I could, you can certainly you could have the engineering staff and Rand Tool contact me, Fred Rank, at the Federal Highway Administration. I'm on the web page for the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, and you can contact me through that or by phone, and my number is 708-283-3545, and I'll be glad to help technically.
All right. I need to jump in here. We're almost at our midpoint here, and I have another caller I'd like to include, and also I'd like to introduce again our guests. They're two engineers, civil engineers, who spent a lot of time thinking about traffic issues, and particularly here we're talking this morning about pedestrian safety as it applies to our community, but also others. Our guests are John LaPlante. He is Vice President and Chief Transportation Planning Engineer for the firm of T.Y. Lynn International. That's a civil and structural engineering firm that's particularly interested in planning, design, construction of transportation infrastructure. He also worked for the City of Chicago for 30 years in various positions in the transportation engineering area, has been involved in a lot of projects around the Chicago area. And also our other guest is Fred Rank. He is a safety engineer with Federal Highway Administration. He's an engineer for their Midwestern Resource Center. And they're both joining us by phone, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have another caller to talk with, someone here in Urbana where we are, line 2. Hello.
Do you have any solutions for the pedestrians and bicycle riders and car drivers who use cell phones while they are in motion? And it's not just the car drivers. I've seen bicycle riders going through intersections talking on cell phones. I've seen pedestrians crossing streets wrapped up in their iPods or their cell phones. And we did one of the fatalities on campus was a young woman talking to her mommy on the cell phone. A college student, and she walked into a turning bus and was killed. I don't know how one changes that sort of human behavior. Got any ideas?
Yeah, I know the problem. In fact, when we were down teaching the course, and Fred and I were down teaching the course in February, and we were walking around the campus, at one point we saw a turning car, the driver talking in his cell phone, almost wipe out a bicyclist who was also talking in his cell phone. And they missed each other, and I'm not sure either one was aware that the other was ever even there. They just went on their happy way, missing each other by inches. And I don't know the answer to that either. It's just a stupid thing to do. Fred, do you have any advice on how to educate people to not do things that are stupid?
Well, yes, and first of all, let me say it's very unfortunate that the person was killed in the crash back earlier in the year. That's an unfortunate thing, and my heart goes out to the family and the situation for this. The widespread pervasive use by students of iPods and cell phones is something fairly new. When John and I were in school, we still wore ties to class and carried our slide rules on our belt. We come from a different time. We didn't have the issues with iPods and cell phones. You needed to be, it was well understood, you needed to be alert as a pedestrian on any college campus because of one thing, the traffic. The major change that I see in the University of Illinois campus, and is a good one, is more and more of the streets have been closed off to vehicular traffic to separate them clearly from the pedestrians and the large amount of pedestrian flows on campus. And every measure and step that the university advances with in restricting vehicular traffic where students cross is a good thing. And in fact, it is the key underlying principle in towards a good, safe campus. But unfortunately, the campus is spread out over a lot of public streets. And one of the things, it's a major issue. I noticed that on the U of I has a website for looklistenandlive.com safety, the Live It Up, Play It Safe, in which they reach out to students in their format of a website of look before you cross, cross where you, you know, always look and see. And it goes without saying when you, or should be without saying, that you really need to look and watch any time you approach where traffic is and where you cross. And if you don't, well, there's not a lot that can be done to protect you. Even signals wouldn't protect you in that kind of a situation, because you still need to follow the signals, so you only cross when it's your turn.
Yeah. So it's obviously, and as you say, I think here on the campus and perhaps other places, what they're trying to do is just make pedestrians very aware that they need to be aware, that they need to pay attention, they need to watch the traffic, they need to be very careful. At the same time, it seems that we do have a growing problem with has been called the distracted driver. There are all sorts of things that draw the driver's attention, and hand various kinds of electronic devices, including cell phones, are among them. I wonder, either or both of you, do you think that we're going to come to a point where there's going to be more laws that say things like you can't use a cell phone when you're driving, or other sorts of electronic devices to try to cut down on that problem? Either Fred or you can go, and then John, maybe you.
It's already an ordinance in the city of Chicago, and I don't know how effective it has been. I think there's maybe a slight diminution in people driving with cell phones. More and more, I've heard people talk, say, "Well, hold on, I got to pull over. I can't talk right now because I'm driving." And then they'll pull over and then finish their call or something like that. But that happens more than it used to. But I don't know that it's making much of a dent.
Well, a more recent study by NHTSA found that distracted driving was a factor in 38% of all intersection crashes. Distracted driving is a big, big issue across the board. Distracted walking, from what John and I saw when we were on the campus, and it was good to be back on the campus after graduating 36 years earlier. Again, it was the students and the pervasive use of iPods and cell phones made it distracted walking a real, real issue in my view. Mm-hmm. I found it kind of strange watching all that behavior. It's so different from when I was a student on campus.
Let me ask you just one additional quick question about something a little bit different, and then I have a couple of callers here I want to get to. Is there something that can be done other than, short of education, in terms of the design of your walkways to try to discourage pedestrians from crossing in the middle of the block? Jaywalking on this campus is a terrible, terrible problem. And again, it can be very dangerous to pedestrians. It can be very challenging to motorists because people will walk out in front of you maybe when you quite don't expect it, or maybe if you are trying to expect it. Is that something that you can deal with by design, or does that have to be an educational kind of thing where you just have to try to tell people, look, don't do that. It's just very dangerous.
Well, this is Fred Rank. The jaywalking is sort of a funny term, and I'll say it just in that context. It's where you cross away from an intersection, and it's usually associated with inappropriate crossing. The reality of it is that pedestrians cross where they feel it's appropriate and safe, and the best thing that we can do as a tool in supporting pedestrians is to plan and design for their crossing needs, and that includes away from intersections on a case-by-case study. And There is good techniques available with curb bulb outs and raised medians in the middle of the street to provide for locations that are not at an intersection, not at a location with stop signs all the way around or signals all the way around for pedestrians to cross. And the mid-block crossing is probably best done where you have a median, so the pedestrian only has to look one way when crossing, and only that distance is considerably shorter than crossing the whole street at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And then they can cross the other side looking at only that one approach direction of traffic. Mid-block crossings with a median and curb bulb outs can be quite as safe, just as safe as crossing at an intersection.
So you just figure that they're going to do it. You just want to set up the infrastructure, if it's possible, to make it easier, give them less territory to cross.
Yes.
So an island to stand on when they're in the middle. And then I suppose that, again, that works best when you have your street is divided by the median so that on either side of the median, traffic is only going one way.
Yes, and I say this from experience in dealing with college students on the campus of North Central College in Naperville from back when I was city traffic engineer there, that even though we had some locations in which pedestrians crossed in a wide swath of an arterial street, by narrowing up the street, putting in curb bulb outs, facilitating their crossing, we found that they would naturally go. They made the right choice to go to the place with the least hazard that offered them the best security in crossing as a pedestrian, and it was fairly self-training. The neat thing about it, what I always noticed was, is that for the most part in Naperville, the neighborhood dogs would go to cross at that location, and it seemed to help the students know what to follow in terms of a good, safe place. I used to show the videotape of the neighborhood dogs crossing and dealing with the student body there and their concerns about pedestrian safety.
Yeah, okay.
One of the other things has to do with campus design, and that is, wherever the major doors to a facility are, or if there's a walkway that's cutting through the campus, when it comes to a street, that's where people are going to want to cross. And so at those points, you should know that people are going to want to cross there. If there's a bus stop, people want to cross the street. And so those are places where you'd most likely want to put in medians and or curb bulb outs to shorten the distance and make it easier to cross.
Okay, let's talk with some other folks here. Next is Urbana, line one. Hello.
Is this me?
Yes.
Okay. You've talked twice about the importance of slowing cars down, and the response to one of the accidents was to set up the campus speed zone, 25 miles an hour. I wonder about the efficiency of this if you don't have a discrimination between campus streets, such as on campus by Wright Street or in the middle of the, and the streets on the south end by the farm, where you have St. Mary's Road going by farms and the assembly hall, and the speed limit is 25 miles an hour. Drivers going down that street and say, well, this is stupid. I think I can go 30 without any danger. And that erodes their consciousness of the fact that when it's 25 miles an hour in the more important areas, they should, in fact, be going 25. If you come to the intersection of St. Mary's and First, if you turn left, it's 35. If you go straight, it's 25. If you turn right on First Street, it's 30. That's three different speed limits at one intersection. That seems kind of senseless. Couldn't they have planned it a little better and been a little more discriminatory about how they set up the 25-mile-an-hour zone? Mike, that's my question.
Well, it's a very good question. One or the other, both of you could comment on that. I don't know who would like to go first.
The design of a complete street, using the term that you had used earlier, is to design it for all the users that want to use it, who will be there, and to work outward from there. So if you have an area where it's wheeled up and you have a lot of pedestrians and on-street parking and cars, then the speed limit should match that street.
I agree.
And the design would force people to go that speed. I'm not... Fred may be more familiar with St. Mary's than I am, but... If that's an area where there are a lot of people crossing and moving around, then appropriate, it would be appropriate to do that. Otherwise, it wouldn't.
I agree. That's my question.
I understand your question, Fred Rank here. I'm not sure quite how to respond it. I think I know a little about what that road used to look like, but my recollection's probably at least 30 years old and goes back to when
right.
the assembly hall was first built.
Yep.
So I'm going to hold back without,
I didn't
I
mean
don't
to,
know the
to,
specifics.
Okay. I guess I didn't mean to bog you down on details, but I would think when you put in a zone, it should be they should plan not to have it apply so broadly that it begins to lose its efficacy because people will start ignoring it because they know it's wrong in parts, and then they forgot how important it is in other areas. You sort of
I understand your points, and
yeah.
Again, that's a local decision by the the local agency
okay.
that's responsible for St. Mary's Road. I would urge you to go back to them and talk to them.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Well, I do think, and I hear what the caller is saying, and I think other people have asked this kind of question when they look at the universe that. Area of roads that's considered to be within this university zone where the speed is 25 miles an hour, and that so you could be on a street in this zone, and then one block one way or another, you end up in one of the cities where the speed limit is different. And I think that some people would argue that zone in which people are going 25 miles an hour actually should be bigger and should include some of the city streets. And for some reason, it seems that the cities don't want to do that. And I suppose it comes down to an issue of everybody getting together, the cities and the university, and coming to some kind of an agreement on what kind of territory you're going to carve out for your lower limit.
And then designing the street so that it looks like that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
If St. Mary's Road is designed with 12-foot lanes and no parking and clear sight distances and you can see forever, then you can put up a sign that says 25 miles per hour, but your roadway is telling you, I want you to go 50 miles an hour. And so you have a mixed message there. And if you really do want, if it's important that people go 25 miles an hour there, if there's a lot of pedestrian crossings, if there's a lot of hazards or potential hazards, then you need to redesign the roads so that it also says, I want you to go 25 miles an hour. And so the two kind of go hand in hand.
Well, let's talk with some other folks. Next is Champagne. This is line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the traffic lights again. I was wondering if any work is being done on making smart lights that are networked together. It seems like we waste a lot of time and energy at stopping at lights when there's nobody coming or no traffic. I mean, it just seems like they should be networked together and control the traffic better. Is there any work being done on that? And I'll listen offline.
Fred Rank here, and the answer is yes. And it's at the national level, the state level. But most of the work is being done by the cities themselves. Cities have the majority of the traffic signals all over the country. And large area coordination of traffic signals is a wonderful thing. There are many good-sized communities, cities in America, in which you can travel long distances in peak hours on a constant green going through the whole system without slowing or having to speed up to stay with the signals. It's all about what you and your local community want to do. I can point you to examples here in Illinois where traffic signal coordination has been in place for 10, 15 years, and everybody enjoys it as a great benefit of the livability of the community. And there are still a lot of places that haven't chosen. It's a choice. It's very low cost to do, to make it work. But they just haven't chosen to fund the simple, small, low-cost measures that it takes to run traffic signals coordinated across a large area. It's your local choice. FHWA promotes it. We're big on reducing congestion. And oh, by the way, not only do coordinated traffic signals reduce congestion, they reduce crashes. They're a major safety measure to run traffic signals coordinated.
We have about 10 minutes left here in the show. Let me just jump in real quick and introduce our two guests once again, John LaPlante and Fred Rank, and tell you a little bit about them. Fred Rank is an engineer for the Federal Highway Administration's Midwestern Resource Center. He also worked as a city traffic engineer for the city of Naperville, was manager of Highway Traffic Safety Department for the National Safety Council for 6 years. He's joining us by telephone. Also with us is John LaPlante. He is currently Vice President and Chief Transportation Planning Engineer for the firm of T.Y. Lynn International. That's a civil and structural engineering firm that specializes in transportation infrastructure. He also spent a number of years working for the City of Chicago in various transportation areas as a transportation engineer. And we're talking about particularly about pedestrian safety, but other kinds of traffic safety issues are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And John, I think I cut in on you there. It's just you were about to make a comment.
No, I just wanted to maybe just check in with Fred a little bit, but there is a cost to coordinating all your signals, and that is they somehow have to be interconnected. Otherwise, they can't speak to one another and know when the other one is going. And you can sometimes do that with the internal clock, but that gets messed up every time you change power to a signal. So then a hardwire interconnect is probably the easiest way, or sometimes a radio interconnect is, they've done a little bit of that, or with phone lines. But it's not quite as cheap as I heard Fred saying there. So once you've done that, then once they're interconnected, then having a system is that's fairly relatively easy thing to do then.
Okay.
This is Fred. Yeah. I'll still call it low cost. The unit cost, even with hardwiring or fiber optic tie communication cables between the signals in a system, is still less than a tenth of the cost of each new signal.
That's true.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, I'm really interested in this aspect of a driving culture that actually respects pedestrians' rights. And I was actually pretty horrified when I came to Champaign because it doesn't seem like drivers respect, pedestrians when they're crossing the street. And I've been in cars with people from Chicago, from locals, and I expect them to slow down. I'm coming from California where, we're drilled in, it's in our head, we have to respect pedestrians' rights. And out here, it just doesn't seem like it's taken, hold. The other thing is, I've been to Canada, and I believe it was Edmonton, and, people just, press the walk signal, and boom, it changes right away. Cars stop. They don't try to run, run the lights or get a little, an extra inch out of it. It's just, it's ingrained into the culture. So I wanted to see, what cities in the United States are actually seen as being very respectful toward pedestrians and what they see, what they think are some of the major obstacles.
Good okay. questions. This is Fred, and then I'm going to ask John to jump in.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, California is somewhat unique in what you just stated, is that the drivers are very watchful for pedestrians and will stop very quickly for them when they enter the street. And as you've come to Champaign-Urbana in Illinois and our wonderful winters, and there's nothing better than a middle January 8 a.m. class on the University of Illinois campus to say, welcome, you're not in California anymore. But the culture is different. The other 49 states, by and large, well, they have drivers who are very mobile and move from state to state and place to place, and everybody's in a hurry. And it all goes back to people being in a hurry, and they're in a hurry. And pedestrians quite often are not at the top of their list. There are places within the states that have good pedestrian climates and good pedestrian situations, and drivers are fairly respectful, but not quite like California. John, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a few cities where I felt kind of comfortable. I just came back from a week in Seattle where I was at a conference.
Oh, yeah.
And I felt very comfortable, although talking to the people in Seattle, they were bemoaning the fact that drivers were not giving them any respect. And a lot of it has to do with perspective. I feel it's a national problem overall, and that's why we're doing a lot of these pedestrian safety training courses, is to try and teach cities and municipalities and governmental agencies on how to design their facilities so they can be safer, and how we can design our roads so that they can be safer. And again, if you design a road so it looks like it's a place for pedestrians to be and want to be, then the crashes go down. And if it looks like a cross between an expressway and a suburban arterial, then the crashes go up. And so a lot of, there's things we can do from a design standpoint, but there's sure a lot more we need to do in terms of educating our motorists.
Yeah, Fred Rank here. Let me speak to it. There are cities in Illinois that take, that enforce the speed limits very strictly, that enforce driver behavior in terms of running red lights and turning where turns are prohibited, that sort of things that are illegal driver behavior, that enforce them very strictly. And not strangely at all, they have low crash rates. They have good safety records. It's a choice that you make at the community level, your police department, and direction that that police department makes. If they choose and have a credible to do so and enforce traffic regulations, you usually have good driver behavior. Drivers are just responding to where they get feedback from police or they receive no feedback. Communities that allow large tolerances on posted speed limits have high speed levels and tend not to have very good driver behavior at traffic signals with red lights or in regard to pedestrians. So the choice is, you know, Champaign-Urbana's to make as to what's given emphasis and what isn't.
We have a couple of minutes left. I have several callers. We'll try to include at least one, maybe two. Next, we'll go talk with someone in Charleston, line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just a comment as a driver. I have often wondered about the idea of actually painting the speed limits on the road. You miss the speed limit signs because you're looking at the traffic. And I wondered if there has been any ideas or concepts about that.
Fred Rank here. The answer is yes. And the mark, putting regulations or guidance, either in the form of regulation for speed limits or warning messages for regulation ahead or for guidance as to which lane to be in, that concept is known as horizontal signing when you do it with markings. The research is good and solid, that it's very effective, that it helps drivers. The issue goes back to how much money is available for the markings to paint them and keep them maintained. Many cities are removing markings, no longer painting them, because of the cutbacks that they're experiencing and money available for signs and marking. Pure and simple. Decisions not to repaint crosswalks, not to repaint stop-ahead messages, it all goes back to money and where it's spent.
And the cost of maintaining a horizontal sign, the street markings, is much higher than the vertical sign, the sign on the side of the road, just because cars don't drive over the signs on the side of the road, but they're constantly wearing out the paint, and so you have to keep replacing that.
All right. Well, I thank the caller. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. This would be line one. Hello.
Yeah, is that me?
Yes.
Yeah. I have several comments. I'll see if I can get to them. I was recently in Chicago, and there are many lanes there that are marked on the city streets, which worked out very well, although sometimes we still find it necessary to go on the sidewalk for a couple of blocks, because if there was parking and traffic coming behind you, you kind of get squeezed between the cars that are moving and the cars that are stationary. Also on the lakefront, there was a shared path, bikers, walkers, and inline skaters, and that worked out fine if the path was wide enough. On campus, I find it's a problem that people tend to totally... pedestrians tend to totally ignore the fact that there are separate bike paths and saunter along them in a way they would never do in the street. And in the summer, in the warm weather, there's a lot of traffic on those bike paths. But riding around the cities here, I recently rode to North Prospect. That was extremely bike unfriendly. But riding from west to east into East Urbana, that worked out all right. But I was also recently in Germany, and I used to live there. And there are a lot of bike paths, and people expect bikers. Everybody bikes. Men in their business suits bike. Moms going to shops to shop for the day bike. And so because so many people bike, drivers expect them and look for them. And the biggest problem I found on North Prospect was the drivers coming out of the side streets or parking lots would go practically nose all the way out into Prospect, and there you are, you know, coming along right at the edge, and they like are totally yeah. oblivious that you exist.
We just got about a minute here, and I don't know how much of that we can address, and which of you would like to talk about that.
I can just hit a couple items. The bike path on the lakefront of Chicago is 14 feet wide in most places, with 2 foot of running trail on each side. In addition, and even then, it when on good summer days, it's jammed. People being on street is still the safest place for them to be. My experience in Champaign was that there were a lot of bicycle paths that like cut across and looked like places for pedestrians to be, and a lot of those I thought that might be safer if they were on street than if they were these side paths or cut through paths. Fred, you grew up there. You have a better feel for that than I do.
Well, I won't say. Well, it's probably, you know, John, good point. I probably did grow up at the U of I. And the bicycle path system there is, I always thought, was one of the better things on campus. In today's situation, in today's design context, each of the individual paths are not wide enough, and some of the placement and some of the issues are certainly not up to standards that we would do today if we were building it new. I wish I could help you a little more specifically. I'm trying to envision the location you mentioned, and it's just, the problem is I'm an engineer, and I do best when I can see things and see the layout of it in terms of identifying how to improve it, how to make it better. But you have a very good engineer in the Champaign city. I'd urge you to contact him. He has made a lot of great recommendations as part of their pedestrian-related improvements on the campus and nearby. His name is Chris Sololowski. I'd really urge you to contact him and see what he has to say and take your concerns to him. Chris has certainly made a lot of recommendations, developed a lot of improvements to be put in place for the campus area and nearby that will improve things for peds and bikes.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop. I'm sure, though, we'll get a chance to talk about these issues again on future programs. But for the moment, we need to say thanks to our guest, Fred Rank. He is an engineer with the Federal Highway Administration's Midwestern Resource Center. Mr. Rank, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And John LaPlante, he is Vice President, Chief Transportation Planning Engineer for the firm of T.Y. Lynn International. And Mr. LaPlante, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Hey, thanks. Great to be with you.
All right. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of Alice and Robert Campbell. In the next hour, Doyle Moore will be here a couple days early this week talking about picnic food. So I hope you'll stay with us. Right now, though, we'll need to take a break so we can bring you an update on the markets and news. Please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's 10:59 with this market update. I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat is down sharply in Kansas City and now down in Chicago as well on uncertainty about global stocks as well as decent weather. The July wheat contract in Kansas City at 581 a bushel, down 15.5 cents. September down 15 at 580. July wheat on the Board of Trade in Chicago at 573.5 a bushel, down 8.5. September down 6.5 at 590.5. December wheat 602.5, down 8. The corn market sort of firm to lower on news of good weather and a little bit of profit-taking, especially after the higher-than-expected plantings report acreage from Friday. July corn right now down a penny at 328.5.